It seemed to me just like a Hollywood scene. And if someone had said, cut, and everybody got up and walked away, that would have been it. But unfortunately, it was real life.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kevin, and this is Just Thought Lounge. Today, we're looking at a case that has made headlines all over the world. The latest development only last month was a reminder that this horrific and puzzling mystery remains unsolved. The Affaire de Chivalines is also known as the Annecy shootings or the Al-Halim murders. In September 2012, there was a shooting in a clearing at the base of the Alps overlooking Lake Annecy near the small village of Chivalines in southeastern France. The rapid attack left four people dead, a father, mother, and grandmother from a visiting British family on holiday with their two young girls, as well as a cyclist who was a local Frenchman and father of three. Dozens of potential theories have been proposed by police and the press, and multiple arrests have been made, including the latest in January 2022, but there is still so much left unknown. Let's take a look. There is a single main road that runs through the small village of Chivalines, a popular holiday spot. The village is next to Lake Annecy, which sits at the base of the Alps. It is picturesque and the perfect place for a summertime holiday escape. There's a camping ground near the village, Le Solitaire du Lac, but not much else. In the village proper, there is a war memorial and a small church with a cemetery. Just past a large barn at the edge of the village, there is a rough-looking road that leads up and into the forest. The road is called the Route Forestière Domaniale de la Combière. It leads up to a clearing where cars can park, but the area just a few miles past this clearing is restricted. It is meant for forestry workers only, no general public access. So, in the strictest sense, those that ascend the hill on this road from the village, in order to descend, should come back the exact same way. The afternoon of the 5th of September 2012. It was a Wednesday and a clear and sunny day in Chivalines. Saad Al-Hali, his wife Iqbal, and their two young daughters, 4-year-old Zina and 7-year-old Zainab, along with Iqbal's mother, Suhala, left their campsite near the village and headed out in their car to search for some trails to take a walk. Zainab had asked her father if they could go for a walk in the forest that day. A walk seemed a nice idea, so with this intention, the family ascended the Combière in their BMW, presumably seeking a walking trail. The family were not alone on the road that day. Sylvain Morier, a local to the area and an avid cyclist, was likewise making his way up the hill on his new racing bike. Both the Al-Hali family in their maroon BMW and Sylvain on his bike passed a slower moving cyclist on their way up the hill. That cyclist's name was Brett Martin, a British citizen with a holiday home in France. When Brett reached the clearing, he found a disturbing scene.
And I started taking stock of the people inside, and it became fairly evident that the injuries of the people inside didn't match what one would think people would be like from a car accident in a car park. I've never seen people who've been shot before, for real, more the Hollywood stuff, but actually it seemed to me just like a Hollywood scene. And if someone had said, cut, and everybody got up and walked away, that would have been it. But unfortunately, it was real life. It became quite obvious now, taking stock, that it was a gun crime. I then started scanning the woods to see whether there was some nutter or who knows what with a gun, and I was going to be the next person shot. Was it some sort of hunter with a high-powered rifle shooting from a distance or what? And of all the moments in the world to have no signal on your mobile phone, that was it.
Zainab, the older of the two girls, was outside the car. He could see that she was seriously injured. Brett, formerly of the British Air Force, used his first aid training to place her in the recovery position and moved her to a safer location away from the vehicle on the road. He also found Sylvain laying on the ground. He searched for a pulse but found none. Brett then makes the difficult decision to leave Zainab alone while he sought help. It was clear to him that those visible inside the car were past saving. Back on his bike, Brett encountered hikers about 400 yards down the road. In broken French, he summoned them to the scene. The male hiker, a man named Philippe, was in partial shock from the bloody scene. At first, Philippe assumes that Brett is responsible. His instinct was to punch the man, so he goes to do just that when Brett threw up his hands and screamed, "It's not me, it's not me." Philippe regained his composure and then managed to get a signal on his cell phone. Emergency services were called out to the clearing.
Le conducteur, un homme.
There was the driver, a man, and two women also dead in the back. Next to the vehicle, there was a cyclist dead, and there was a young girl found nearby.
A helicopter took that girl from the scene. She's now in a critical condition in hospital.
8 hours after Brett and Philippe called the authorities to the scene, 4-year-old Zina was discovered inside the car. She was physically unharmed and had been hiding tucked under her mother's skirt, too scared to speak out. It was Zina who would confirm the identities of her parents to the French authorities the next day.
I can confirm that Mr. Saad Al-Hilli is indeed the deceased, and he was killed along with members of his family. That was confirmed to us by his young 4-year-old daughter. We asked her to tell us who she was with, and she said, my daddy, and gave us his name, my mummy, and my sister. So we do know that it was that poor family in the car.
One widely held view that first emerged in the days following the attack was that the shooting was the act of a professional killer. There are clear facts that would lead to this conclusion, as well as a few indications that may counter this generally accepted interpretation.
And I asked him whether it meant that it was more likely that it was the work of a professional, of a hitman. And he said, no, not necessarily. He said that there are cases of murder where this can be done before, but he said that they're not ruling anything out at the moment.
Sylvain was also hit by one final shot squarely between the eyes, what prosecutor Eric Mayot referred to as execution style. The execution and precision of the shooting would suggest a professional. Add to this the number of victims and that a child was involved, and it's easy to conclude that this was the act of a hardened, efficient, and experienced killer. However, French investigators also noted that the shooter left 21 shell casings on the ground, which a professional probably would not have done, they thought. The weapon used was an antique 765mm Luger issued by the Swiss Army more than 60 years earlier, which was also thought to be an odd choice for a professional killer. But it holds only 8 bullets, meaning that it was likely reloaded quickly, twice. The investigators are certain of the weapon because of a piece of the butt of the gun that had broken off at the scene. The first person of interest considered and then cleared was the English cyclist Brett Martin. A former military man and fellow Englishman with a holiday home in the area, he was first to the scene, so was immediately suspicious. He was swabbed for gunpowder residue, and the detectives checked and rechecked his story. Brett was firm that he did not hear 21 gunshots fired less than 200 meters from where he was riding up the hill, so investigators conducted acoustic tests and concluded that, with the sound of the nearby river reverberating in the forest, he was not likely to have heard anything at all. Free of any suspicion, Brett Martin became a key eyewitness. Aside from the maroon BMW and Sylvain passing him on his bike, Brett saw 2 vehicles on the Côme d'Hyères that afternoon. Sylvain had overtaken him roughly 25 minutes prior to him reaching the clearing. A large vehicle, a 4x4, came down the hill, passed him about halfway through that 25-minute climb. He also noted that a motorcycle passed him at some point, also coming down the hill. Police concluded, based on Zainab's and Brett's accounts, that he must have arrived within moments of the shooter. Monsieur Mayot believed he arrived within 10 seconds, a minute at most, after the killer had left.
We are hoping, and we want, of course, to speak to the 7-year-old girl. We feel terrible for her. It is awful that a victim, and especially a child, is also a key witness. This will, of course, have had a profound effect on her. She has suffered, and it is very difficult. But we hope that at 7, she is that little bit older. And it's the age of reason. We hope that she can tell us what she saw.
When Zainab awoke, she was able to recount very little. She said there was one bad man, which confirmed the suspicions of the French detectives that this was the act of a single individual. She recovered in hospital. Neither girl was pressured to provide any more information that could jeopardize their physical, mental, or emotional rehabilitation. Both a 4x4 vehicle and a motorbike, perhaps the same vehicle spotted by Brett Martin, were reported by forestry workers on the other side of the clearing, that is, on the section of road that is not intended for public access. A single worker recalled a 4x4 BMW, an English make, which was notable because of the driver's side on the right. 2 of his colleagues also saw the motorbike. Indeed, the motorcyclist was stopped by 2 of them, who told the man he was not allowed to be in the restricted area. A likeness of the motorcyclist was sketched out at this time, but it was not released to the public immediately. In fact, it was held back for nearly a year. With the attention that the case was receiving in the press, it seemed inconceivable to the investigators that any innocent person who was in the area that day would not have voluntarily come forward. So the sketch, they thought, could very well be a depiction of the killer. Best not to let him know that he was spotted and that they know what he looks like. So they tucked that one away, for now. Back in the UK, police coordinated with French investigators to begin piecing together the story of the Al-Hali family with the hope of uncovering a motive for the horrible crime. Saad Al-Hali was a 50-year-old engineer. He had met his wife Iqbal, 47, who was a dentist through family connections when she was living in the United Arab Emirates. Iqbal's mother, Suhala, was 77 years old. She was visiting the family in England and then on the vacation in France from her permanent home, which was in Stockholm, Sweden. On the 9th of September, 4 days after the shooting in Chevaline, the family's house in Claygate, Surrey, is searched for any indications of who may have wanted to harm the family.
Police are trying to gather all the background information they can on the family. They're working on a number of theories, and judging by recent comments, clearly no more than they're making public. But for now, the mystery remains.
Television satellite trucks lined the street and reporters watched from behind police tape until they were pushed back 200 yards and all the houses nearby were evacuated as the Royal Logistics Corps bomb disposal unit was brought in. They claimed that there was something potentially hazardous in a shed behind the house. This turned out to be a false alarm, we think, because nothing more was reported on it. There were two interesting items that did come from the search, however. The first was that Saad evidently owned a taser gun, one that was illegal to possess in the UK. It's curious why he would take the risk of owning such a weapon. The second was that he had very recently changed the locks to the house. Was it possible that he knew himself or his family to be in danger? This was not the first time within that year that Saad had changed the locks to the house. The first instance was connected to an ongoing dispute with his brother Zaid over a large inheritance left by their father. It seems that Zaid Al-Hali, Saad's older brother, had initially been offered the full inheritance of their father in line with traditional practice. Kadim Al-Hali had been a successful businessman in Iraq before leaving with his family for England in the early 1970s. Before he passed away in 2011, he altered the distribution of his fortune equally between his two sons. That included the house in Claygate, where Saad and his family lived, as well as some funds, reportedly up to 1 million euros, so comfortably over 1 million US dollars, which were held in a Swiss bank account. Saad's vacation spot in Annecy was only a 40-minute drive to Geneva, where the account was accessible in theory. Saad was said to have intended to make that trip while in the area, but never made it. Zaid says this is not the case. The account had been frozen by the bank over their dispute, so Saad knew better than to try to access it. Regardless, arguments over the inheritance between the two brothers had turned heated. Zaid, having lost his wife a few years prior, had initially moved into the family home in Claygate, a house that he owned 50% of, only to be locked out by his brother. This was following a shouting match that escalated to a minor physical altercation between the two brothers. It ended only after police were called out to the residence. This was in October 2011, nearly a year prior to the shooting. The two ceased communicating to each other directly and spoke only through their lawyers in the months before Saad's death. The dispute included not only the million in the Swiss account and the family home, estimated at over a million, but also an apartment in Spain, which could have added an additional 100,000 US dollars. Late September 2012, police obtained a search warrant for Zaid's home. They sit down with him for questioning multiple times over many cumulative hours. They delve into the brother's dispute and they seek to catch Zaid in a contradiction in his statements. 7 months go by with regular sessions covering much the same ground as no new information was being turned up. Zaid is consistent in his statements and cooperation during that time. Eventually, French authorities decided to apply more pressure and they requested that Zaid not speak with authorities in England, but make the trip to France instead. Zaid refused. He had become increasingly distrustful of the French police and very disappointed in their investigation. He believed they were wasting time pursuing theories of the murders based on his brother being the target. Zaid firmly believed that Sylvain Mollier was the intended victim, that the French investigation was corrupt, and that the focus on him was based on bias. For almost 3 weeks, he heard nothing more about appearing in France. Then, on the 13th of June 2013, they arrested him.
Police in Britain are continuing to question a man on suspicion of conspiracy to murder a family gunned down in the French Alps last year. The 54-year-old suspect is now known to be Zaid Al-Hilili, the brother of the head of the family. He was arrested on Monday at his home in Chessington, a leafy town in the southern county of Surrey which borders London. However, they stress they have no formal evidence against him, but now have enough elements to question him as a suspect.
Exactly 1 year on, and Zaid remained under arrest for the crime, although he was free on bail, and other lines of inquiry were still being examined. A joint French and British press conference was held to offer the public an update on what efforts were being undertaken. French police had spoken to 800 witnesses and recorded over 3,000 statements. Lines of inquiry were being pursued in 23 different countries. In the UK, 560 statements have been taken, 1,600 exhibits for evidence have been compiled, and 1,300 distinct reports had led to additional follow-ups. Prosecutor Eric Mayot reported that every satellite company in Europe dug through its archive of images from the 5th of September 2012, and these were studied for any potential clues. There were two bits of unmatched DNA on the Al-Hilili's car, but a search of every known DNA database in Europe couldn't identify them. These were skin cells that could have been left in very innocuous ways anyways. Over 4,000 cell phones had pinged the nearest tower on the day of the murders, and everyone was being tracked down to identify potential witnesses. Footage from security cameras from England all the way to Chevaline had been compiled to trace the Al-Hilili's trip to the campground, Le Solitaire du Lac, where they had been staying. Police could not identify any vehicles tracking them. They were not followed from Surrey in England to Annecy in France. Zaid was released from his bail in January 2014. There was simply no evidence connecting him to the crime. He gave investigators all the information that he could about his family history, his whereabouts, and anything else he could provide. It is true that he and his brother were at odds before his death, but causing the assassination of the family made no sense.
The French police aren't keeping in touch with you about the investigation?
No, I don't know anything about the investigation. That's all I know, is what I read in the papers.
Obviously, you have been arrested, you've been bailed, the charges have been, or they've decided not to pursue things. Are you personally relieved that the investigation is going in another direction?
Well, of course, I am, because that's where it should be, from the beginning.
Monsieur Mayot announced three distinct angles from which to approach theories of the crime based on three targets, each of which the police were examining. First, the suspicion that was vigorously explored in the first year, which was that the Al-Hilili family, particularly Saad, was the intended target. The second was that Sylvain Mollier, the French cyclist, did not happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, but rather was the intended target himself. The third alternative was that it was a random act. All victims were there when they should not have been, and either stumbled onto seeing something they should not have, or were faced with an unbalanced maniac who killed at random. Based on the chosen weapon, a pistol that held only 8 bullets, the police concluded that there was only one target, but who was it? The third alternative, the one that assumes that none of the victims were personally targeted, led police to consider anyone in the area who could possibly fit their profile. So in February 2014, a second arrest was made. A local man, Eric Desbousseaux, was arrested in his home a few miles from Lake Annecy. Eric had caught the eye of police for a few circumstantial reasons. First, the proximity to the crime, since he lived only a few miles away. Second, he had a propensity towards guns and was a collector, including antique pistols like the one used in the shooting. Lastly, he was said to have a grudge against foreigners. He was arrested alongside a friend of his, Jean-Luc Falsy. They were detained and questioned at headquarters for 4 days.
Today, police confirmed they found more than 40 weapons, including guns and grenades, at his house. In a press conference earlier, prosecutors said they're sure he was near to the scene at the time, but they say the case is not cleared up and that there's no direct link between him and the murders. French police have now arrested a second man, said to be a friend of the former policeman, who they believe are both involved in arms trafficking. Desbousseaux's resemblance to this EFIT image released last year of a motorcyclist who'd been spotted near the scene led to his arrest. It's since been claimed his mobile phone data indicates he was there.
But DNA tests came back empty. A Luger similar to the one used in the shooting was discovered in a search of his home, but testing found that it was not the same weapon. They also found a motorbike and helmet, but these did not match the description given by the witness of the one close to the scene that day. And the cell data that placed Eric there was arguably useless. It made sense for his cell to ping a tower nearby on that day. It's the area where he lives. A few months later, still working through an extensive list of all potential witnesses, the police interview a former soldier known in Sylvain's circle of acquaintances. His name is Patrice Menegaldo. He was 50 years old, and he lived in Eugene, a village only about 20 minutes from Chevaline. He'd been a paratrooper in the French Foreign Legion. As an ex-soldier, he checked a couple of boxes in terms of potential interest. He knew his way around guns and had likely seen combat action overseas, so was perhaps hardened by these experiences. Police spoke with Patrice in the station for approximately an hour. He was never accused of any involvement in the crime and was never considered a suspect. 2 months later, he shot himself in the head. His suicide note, several pages long, was never released to the public, but according to prosecutors, it reportedly stated that, "I could not handle being a suspect in a murder." But there was nothing actually connecting him to the crime, aside from his own note. Again, he was never accused of the crime. This left investigators wondering why he would consider himself a suspect when they did not. Stalled in the investigation, the decision is made to publicly release the sketch of the motorcyclist seen by the forestry workers on the day of the murders.
The image of a motorcyclist French authorities want to speak to in connection with the murders of four people in the Alps last year. He was seen by two eyewitnesses on the road leading to the murder scene. The artist's impression was done early in the inquiry, but not released until now. The helmet is a rare model which opens at the side to allow for conversations. A spokesperson for the investigation described the man as someone who was close to the scene during a time period that interests us.
The sketch led to hundreds of calls from the public. Initially, this also led to many dead ends, like Eric Desbousseaux, a gun enthusiast, but with no links to any of the victims. But then, in March 2015, the mystery motorcyclist is located.
He had a distinctive goatee and was wearing an unusual motorbike helmet. Surprising then that French investigators only released the image a year after the murders.
There was certainly a lot of frustration among the British at the way the French did this. The reason the French said they sat on it was for so long was because they were scared that the suspect would go into hiding, which is, of course, absurd. Suspects always go into hiding. That's what they do. This release of this photo has finally led to a breakthrough, and that's why he's been arrested. It may well have been that he could have been arrested many months earlier.
The local man was rapidly ruled out. He'd been discovered to be a businessman from Lyon who'd been paragliding in the area. Mayo won't release his name, but insists he has no criminal record of any kind and no connection to any of the victims. His error seems to have been that he, somehow, failed to make the connection between his location that day and the murders that occurred in the area within minutes of him being there. French authorities reportedly, in the early years, made considerable efforts to uncover any Iraqi money connections as a motive. Two European newspapers, Bild in Germany and Le Monde in France, both cited anonymous German intelligence sources which said that Saud's father, Kadim, had smuggled cash out of Iraq for Saddam Hussein and stashed it away in Swiss accounts. Others in the media picked this up and ran with it. They said Saud must have been targeted over the smuggled money. The major problem here, and there are a few, is that far from the Al-Hali family being an ally of Saddam, Kadim had actually fled the country to escape Saddam's regime. Kadim's uncle, a man who had been only 5 years his senior, had been tortured by Saddam's people and had been left with permanent scars that showed it. The Al-Halis hated Saddam, and the remaining family members were understandably disgusted at the suggestion that they had somehow been colluding with the dead dictator. Another Hollywood-worthy theory was based around the assertion that Saud, in his capacity as an engineer at Surrey Satellite Technology Limited, or SSTL, was acquiring and then selling industry secrets to Iran or other nations, which placed him on the radar of secret services in the West, both in France and Britain.
We know the British company that employed him was working for many foreign states. There is still complex work to do because foreign states, industrial espionage, might also mean the intervention of secret services. We do not know. It is an extremely complex part of the inquiry that will require an enormous amount of time. It might not produce results, but the inquiry is far from over on this issue.
Saad did not work on defense contracts. He only did commercial work. And neither his position at the company or his salary at SSTL indicated that he was at a level to be receiving any confidential information, if the company itself even had access to any, which is unlikely. The police were not completely off base in searching down some connection to National Secret Services, however. According to a neighbor of the family in Surrey, about 9 years before the attack, he had an encounter with police that he believed were from the Special Branch, which is a police force in the UK dedicated to counter-terrorism work, concentrating on individuals of interest for national security reasons. This neighbor, a retired finance director who had lived directly across the street, allowed the police use of his driveway in order to monitor the Al-Hilli family. They were apparently there to track the movements of both Saad and his brother Zaid. Beyond that disclosed statement, the French investigators have stated that there is no further information available related to the Secret Service's line of inquiry.
They were just, I would say, a normal family. Just, I never noticed anything unusual about them or anything. They just seemed polite. Used to come out and say good morning, that was it. Nothing else.
The family secrets were not all Saad's. In the course of examining the lives of the Al-Hilli family, French investigators uncover something bizarre and unexpected, and it related to 47-year-old Iqbal, or perhaps we should call her Kelly Thompson. It seems that prior to marrying Saad and starting their family, Iqbal had a secret life in the United States, in New Orleans specifically. Iqbal, going by the name Kelly, married a man named Jimmy Thompson in February 1999. And it gets weirder. On the day that Iqbal lost her life, the 5th of September 2012, Jimmy Thompson, thousands of miles away in his home state of Mississippi, began feeling ill. While working at his antique shop, he complained of pain in his chest and arms. Later that day, Jimmy had a heart attack and lost his life. His death came only hours after his ex-wife was shot and killed on the other side of the Atlantic. Jimmy had an unhealthy diet that rested heavily on deep-fried foods. He was a bit overweight, had some issues with stress, and he was approaching 60. Despite these facts, the coincidence was too much for many to accept, including few members of Jimmy's family, who would later tell the press that they were convinced something nefarious had connected the deaths of Jimmy and Iqbal, despite the distance and the 12 years that had passed since their marriage ended. Iqbal and Jimmy had kept in contact via emails over the years and well into the period when she was remarried and settled with her family in England. It is unclear if Saad was aware of her previous marriage, but investigators found that she had not revealed her past to other relatives. No one in her circle of friends in England seemed to be aware of her past at all. When the FBI approached Jimmy's family to have his body exhumed for an autopsy, they refused. They didn't want to relive the grieving process. Authorities in France and the US have not produced any evidence to indicate a link between the deaths of the two ex-spouses. There appears to be nothing further down this path aside from speculation that Jimmy could have been poisoned. Investigators have stated only that it is an amazing coincidence. And there would be still more coincidences. While delving into the personal life of Iqbal's mother, Suala, the detectives encountered a curious hurdle. When French police went to her home in southern Stockholm, they found that the apartment had been burgled and ransacked. Documents of potential interest to investigators had gone missing. Papers relating to her bank accounts and family documents were also gone. So was a computer. It's unclear what else of potential significance was taken or destroyed, and we may never know. Suella was not a woman of wealth, so this was an unlikely factor towards motive. She had one son, Haydar, who had some diagnosed mental conditions and so was vetted thoroughly by the police, but was also ultimately cleared from being a suspect. So much of the narrative around this horrendous crime has centered around the Al-Hilli family and depicted the French cyclist Sylvain Mollier as an unfortunate witness who happened upon the scene and so also lost his life. But Sylvain was, likely, the first to be shot and suffered one more wound than the victims in the car. His presence in the area was also more likely since he lived locally and often went out cycling. Could he have been the intended target? Sylvain lived close to Chevalin and Eugene. He was a father to a 3-month-old son with his partner Claire, as well as to 2 teenagers from a previous marriage. Claire was 16 years younger than Sylvain. She was only 29 in 2012. Claire was initially reported to have come into a substantial inheritance, giving rise to rumors that Sylvain was living off of her wealth, which was causing anger and disputes with her family. There seems to be no truth to this, however, only rumor. Claire was taking over the family business, but was purchasing it on credit, not being gifted a fortune, and the extent of her family's wealth had been greatly exaggerated. Sylvain also had a polite relationship with his ex-wife and was close to both of his older children. Unlike the Al-Halis, his whole life was local to the investigation, and all of his connections were French, so the investigator claimed to be able to thoroughly track down all potential leads in connection to the cyclist and rule them out. Anything is possible with this case, they say, but theories connected to Sylvain belong at the bottom of the pile. In September 2021, on the 9th anniversary of the shooting, the gendarme forces staged a recreation of the crime and the general sequence of events leading up to it and afterwards. This was done on the location at the clearing and was based on all known witness statements and forensic evidence. They took the results back and assessed. Then in January 2022, they conclude that one witness's statements and timelines do not add up and requires further questioning. That witness? The mystery motorcycle rider first identified by forestry workers driving in the restricted area on the afternoon of the murders. The man that was tracked down only by his unique model helmet and failed to come forward on his own. Still unidentified publicly, he was taken into custody and his home was searched. The man's movements and whereabouts on the day of the killings, as well as the days before and after, were tracked and verified. The latest reports, however, suggest that no charges will be brought anytime soon. The French prosecutor was quoted this January as saying simply, "The investigation continues." There's been nothing further disclosed about the second vehicle, the 4x4 English BMW, that was also seen on the road that day. Zina and Zainab, after a time in foster care in England, were placed under the special guardianship of extended family members. Given that so little is understood about the nature of the crime, there remains concerns that whoever killed their parents and grandmother may still view the girls as a target. They have therefore been given new identities, and nothing more has been publicly released regarding their welfare. Thanks to all of you once again for joining me here today. This is Just Thought Lounge. I'm Kevin, and I'll see you in the next one.